and there was no sound save the wind and the dry grasses. "Even so, they hissed in Serach at the sunset," he said. And as he spoke, the sun went behind the mountains of shadow, and a darkness fell about him, and the wind ceased, and there was silence in the waste. Yet there were ears that heard the words that Húrin spoke, and report of all came soon to the dark throne in the north, and Morgoth smiled, for he knew now clearly in what region Turgon dwelt. Though because of the eagles no spy of his could yet come within sight of the land behind the encircling mountains. This was the first evil that the freedom of Húrin achieved. As darkness fell, Húrin stumbled from the rock and fell into a heavy sleep of grief. But in his sleep he heard the voice of Morwen lamenting, and often she spoke his name, and it seemed to him that her voice came out of Brethil. Therefore, when he awoke with the coming of day, he arose and went back to the Brithiach. And passing along the eaves of Brethil, he came at a time of night to the crossings of Teiglin. The night sentinels saw him, but they were filled with dread, for they thought that they saw a ghost out of some ancient battle mound that walked with darkness about it. And therefore Húrin was not stayed, and he came at last to the place of the burning of Glaurung, and saw the tall stone standing near the brink of Cabed Neramath. But Húrin did not look at the stone, for he knew what was written there, and his eyes had seen that he was not alone. Sitting in the shadow of the stone there was a woman, bent over her knees, and as Húrin stood there silent, she cast back her tattered hood and lifted her face. Grey she was, and old. But suddenly her eyes looked into his, and he knew her. For though they were wild and full of fear, that light still gleamed in them, that long ago had earned for her the name Elethwen, proudest and most beautiful of mortal women in the days of old. "You come at last," she said. "I have waited too long."
"It was a dark road. I have come as I could," he answered.
"But you are too late," said Morwen. "They are lost."
"I know it," he said, "but you are not."
But Morwen said, "Almost. I am spent. I shall go with the sun. Now little time is left. If you know, tell me. How did she find him?"
But Húrin did not answer, and they sat beside the stone and did not speak again. And when the sun went down, Morwen sighed and clasped his hand and was still. And Húrin knew that she had died. He looked down at her in the twilight, and it seemed to him that the lines of grief and cruel hardship were smoothed away.
"She was not conquered," he said.
And he closed her eyes and sat unmoving beside her as the night drew down. The waters of Cabed Neramath roared on, but he heard no sound, and he saw nothing and felt nothing, for his heart was stone within him. But there came a chill wind that drove sharp rain into his face, and he was roused, and anger rose in him like smoke, mastering reason, so that all his desire was to seek vengeance for his wrongs, and for the wrongs of his kin, accusing in his anguish all those who ever had dealings with them. Then he rose up, and he made a grave for Morwen above Cabed Neramath, on the west side of the stone, and upon it he cut these words: "Here lies also Morwen Elethwen." It is told that a seer and harp player of Brethil named Glirhuin made a song, saying that the stone of the hapless should not be defiled by Morgoth, nor ever thrown down, not though the sea should drown all the land, as after indeed befell. And still Tol Morwen stands alone in the water beyond the new coasts that were made in the days of the wrath of the Valar. But Húrin does not lie there, for his doom drove him on, and the shadow still followed him. Now Húrin crossed over Teiglin, and passed southwards down the ancient road that led to Nargothrond. And he saw far off to the eastward the lonely height of Amon-Ruth, and knew what had befallen there. At length he came to the banks of Narog, and ventured the passage of the wild river upon the fallen stones of the bridge, as Mablung of Doriath had ventured it before him. And he stood before the broken doors of Felagund, leaning upon his staff. Here it must be told that after the departure of Glaurung, Mím, the petty dwarf, had found his way to Nargothrond, and crept within the ruined halls, and he took possession of them, and sat there, fingering the gold and the gems, letting them run ever through his hands, for none came nigh to despoil him, from dread of the spirit of Glaurung and his very memory. But now one had come, and stood upon the threshold, and Mím came forth, and demanded to know his purpose. But Húrin said, "Who are you that would hinder me from entering the house of Finrod Felagund?" Then the dwarf answered, "I am Mím, and before the Proud Ones came from over the sea, dwarves delved the halls of Nulu-Kisdin. I have but returned to take what is mine, for I am the last of my people." "Then you shall enjoy your inheritance no longer," said Húrin, "for I am Húrin, son of Galdor, returned from Angband, and my son was Túrin Turambar, whom you have not forgotten, and he it was that slew Glaurung the dragon, who wasted these halls where now you sit, and not unknown is it to me by whom the dragon helm of Dorlomin was betrayed." Then Mím, in great fear, besought Húrin to take what he would, but to spare his life. But Húrin gave no heed to his prayer, and slew him there before the doors of Nargothrond. Then he entered in, and stayed a while in that dreadful place, where the treasures of Valinor lay strewn upon the floors in darkness and decay. But it is told that when Húrin came forth from the wreck of Nargothrond, and stood again beneath the sky, he bore with him out of all that great hoard but one thing only. Now Húrin journeyed eastward, and he came to the meres of twilight above the falls of Sirion. And there he was taken by the elves that guarded the western marches of Doriath, and brought before King Thingol in the Thousand Caves. Then Thingol was filled with wonder and grief when he looked on him, and knew that grim and aged man for Húrin Thalion, the captive of Morgoth. But he greeted him fairly and showed him honour. Húrin made no answer to the king, but drew forth from beneath his cloak that one thing which he had taken with him out of Nargothrond. That was no less a treasure than the Nauglamir, the necklace of the dwarves that was made for Finrod Felagund long years before by the craftsmen of Nogrod and Belagost, most famed of all their works in the elder days, and prized by Finrod while he lived, above all the treasures of Nargothrond. And Húrin cast it at the feet of Thingol with wild and bitter words. "Receive thou thy fee," he cried, "for thy fair keeping of my children and my wife. For this is the Nauglamir, whose name is known to many among elves and men, and I bring it to thee out of the darkness of Nargothrond, where Finrod, thy kinsman, left it behind him when he set forth with Beren, son of Barahir, to fulfill the errand of Thingol of Doriath." Then Thingol looked upon the great treasure, and knew it for the Nauglamir, and well did he understand Húrin's intent. But being filled with pity, he restrained his wrath, and endured Húrin's scorn. And at the last Melian spoke and said, "Húrin Thalion, Morgoth hath bewitched thee. For he that seeth through Morgoth's eyes, willing or unwilling, seeth all things crooked. Long was Turin thy son fostered in the halls of Menigroth, and shown love and honour as the son of the king. And it was not by the king's will, nor by mine, that he came never back to Doriath. And afterwards thy wife and thy daughter were harboured here with honour and goodwill, and we sought by all means that we might to dissuade Morwen from the road to Nargothrond. With the voice of Morgoth thou dost now upbraid thy friends.
And hearing the words of Melian, Húrin stood moveless, and he gazed long into the eyes of the queen. And there, in Menigroth, defended still by the girdle of Melian from the darkness of the enemy, he read the truth of all that was done, and tasted at last the fullness of woe that was measured for him by Morgoth Bauglir. And he spoke no more of what was past, but stooping, lifted up the Nauglamir from where it lay before Thingol's chair, and he gave it to him, saying, "Receive now, Lord, the necklace of the dwarves, as a gift from one who has nothing, and as a memorial of Húrin of Dor Lomin. For now my fate is fulfilled, and the purpose of Morgoth achieved, but I am his thrall no longer." Then he turned away, and passed out from the thousand caves, and all that saw him fell back before his face, and none sought to withstand his going, nor did any know whither he went. But it is said that Húrin would not live thereafter, being bereft of all purpose and desire, and cast himself at last into the western sea, and so ended the mightiest of the warriors of mortal men. But when Húrin was gone from Menigroth, Thingol sat long in silence, gazing upon the great treasure that lay upon his knees. And it came into his mind that it should be remade, and in it should be set the Silmaril. For as the years passed, Thingol's thoughts turned unceasingly to the jewel of Feanor, and became bound to it, and he liked not to let it rest even behind the doors of his innermost treasury. And he was minded now to bear it with him always, waking and sleeping. In those days the dwarves still came on their journeys into Beleriand from their mansions in Ered Lindon, and passing over Gelion at Sarn Athrad, the Ford of Stones, they travelled the ancient road to Doriath. For their skill in the working of metal and stone was very great, and there was much need of their craft in the halls of Menigroth. But they came now no longer in small parties as aforetime, but in great companies well armed for their protection in the perilous lands between Aros and Gelion, and they dwelt in Menigroth at such times in chambers and smithies set apart for them. At that very time, great craftsmen of Nogrod were lately come into Doriath, and the king, therefore, summoning them, declared his desire that if their skill were great enough, they should remake the Nauglamir, and in it set the Silmaril. Then the dwarves looked upon the work of their fathers, and they beheld with wonder the shining jewel of Feanor, and they were filled with a great lust to possess them, and carry them off to their far homes in the mountains. But they dissembled their mind, and consented to the task. Long was their labour, and Thingol went down alone to their deep smithies, and sat ever among them as they worked. In time his desire was achieved, and the greatest of the works of elves and dwarves were brought together and made one, and its beauty was very great, for now the countless jewels of the Nauglamir did reflect and cast abroad in marvellous hues the light of the Silmaril amid most. Then Thingol, being alone among them, made to take it up and clasp it about his neck. But the dwarves in that moment withheld it from him, and demanded that he yield it up to them, saying, "By what right does the Elven King lay claim to the Nauglamir that was made by our fathers for Finrod Felagund, who is dead? It has come to him but by the hand of Húrin the Man of Dor Lomin, who took it as a thief out of the darkness of Nargothrond." But Thingol perceived their hearts,
and saw well that desiring the Silmaril, they sought but a pretext and fair cloak for their true intent. And in his wrath and pride he gave no heed to his peril, but spoke to them in scorn, saying,
"How do ye, of uncouth race, dare to demand aught of me, Elu Thingol, lord of Beleriand, whose life began by the waters of Cui Vienan, years uncounted ere the fathers of the stunted people awoke?"
And standing tall and proud among them, he bade them with shameful words be gone, unrequited, out of Doriath. Then the lust of the dwarves was kindled to rage by the words of the king, and they rose up about him, and laid hands on him, and slew him as he stood. So died, in the deep places of Menegroth, Elwë Singollo, king of Doriath, who alone of all the children of Ilúvatar was joined with one of the Ainur, and he who, alone of the forsaken elves, had seen the light of the trees of Valinor, with his last sight, gazed upon the Silmaril. Then the dwarves, taking the Nauglamir, passed out of Menegroth, and fled eastwards through Region. The tidings went swiftly through the forest, and few of that company came over Aros, for they were pursued to the death as they sought the eastward road, and the Nauglamir was retaken, and brought back in bitter grief to Melian the queen. Yet two there were of the slayers of Thingol, who escaped from the pursuit on the eastern marches, and returned at last to their city far off in the Blue Mountains. And there in Nogrod they told somewhat of all that had befallen, saying that the dwarves were slain in Doriath by command of the Elven king, who thus would cheat them of their reward. Then great was the wrath and lamentation of the dwarves of Nogrod for the death of their kin and their great craftsmen, and they tore their beards and wailed. And long they sat, taking thought for vengeance. It is told that they asked aid from Belegost, but it was denied them, and the dwarves of Belegost sought to dissuade them from their purpose, but their counsel was unavailing, and ere long a great host came forth from Nogrod, and crossing over Gelion, marched westward through Beleriand. Upon Doriath a heavy change had fallen. Melian sat long in silence beside Thingol the king, and her thought passed back into the starlit years and to their first meeting among the nightingales of Nan Elmoth in ages past. And she knew that her parting from Thingol was the forerunner of a greater parting, and that the doom of Doriath was drawing nigh. For Melian was of the divine race of the Valar, and she was a Maia of great power and wisdom. But for love of Elwë Singollo, she took upon herself the form of the elder children of Ilúvatar, and in that union she became bound by the chain and trammels of the flesh of Arda. In that form she bore to him Lúthien Tunúviel, and in that form she gained a power over the substance of Arda, and by the girdle of Melian was Doriath defended through long ages from the evils without. But now Thingol lay dead, and his spirit had passed to the halls of Mandos, and with his death a change came also upon Melian. Thus it came to pass that her power was withdrawn in that time from the forests of Neldoreth and Region, and Esgalduin, the enchanted river, spoke with a different voice, and Doriath lay open to its enemies. Thereafter Melian spoke to none save to Mablung only, bidding him take heed to the Silmaril, and to send word speedily to Beren and Lúthien in Osiriand. And she vanished out of Middle-earth, and passed to the land of the Valar, beyond the western sea, to muse upon her sorrows in the gardens of Lórien, whence she came, and this tale speaks of her no more. Thus it was that the host of the Naugrim, crossing over Aros, passed unhindered into the woods of Doriath, and none withstood them, for there were many and fierce, and the captains of the grey elves were cast into doubt and despair, and went hither and thither purposeless. But the dwarves held on their way, and passed over the great bridge, and entered into Menegroth. And there befell a thing most grievous among the sorrowful deeds of the elder days. For there was battle in the Thousand Caves, and many elves and dwarves were slain. And it has not been forgotten. But the dwarves were victorious, and the halls of Thingol were ransacked and plundered. There fell Mablung of the Heavy Hand, before the doors of the treasury, wherein lay the Nauglamir, and the Silmaril was taken. At that time, Beren and Luthien yet dwelt in Tal Garlan, the Green Isle, in the river Adurant, southernmost of the streams, that falling from Ered Lindon flowed down to join with Gelion. And their son, Dior Eluhil, had to wife Nimloth, kinswoman of Celeborn, prince of Doriath, who was wedded to the lady Galadriel. The sons of Dior and Nimloth were Elured and Elurin, and a daughter also was born to them, and she was named Elwing, which is Star Spray, for she was born on a night of stars, whose light glittered in the spray of the waterfall of Lanthir Lamath beside her father's house. Now word went swiftly among the elves of Osiriand that a great host of dwarves bearing gear of war had come down out of the mountains and passed over Gelion at the Ford of Stones. These tidings came soon to Beren and Luthien, and in that time also a messenger came to them out of Doriath, telling of what had befallen there. Then Beren arose and left Tol Garlan, and summoning to him Dior his son, they went north to the river Askar, and with them went many of the green elves of Osiriand. Thus it came to pass that when the dwarves of Nogrod, returning from Menegroth with diminished host, came again to Sarn Athrad, they were assailed by unseen enemies, for as they climbed up Gelion's banks burdened with the spoils of Doriath, suddenly all the woods were filled with the sound of elven horns, and shafts sped upon them from every side. There very many of the dwarves were slain in the first onset, but some, escaping from the ambush, held together and fled eastwards towards the mountains. And as they climbed the long slopes beneath Mount Dolmed, there came forth the shepherds of the trees, and they drove the dwarves into the shadowy woods of Ered Lindon, whence it is said came never one to climb the high passes that led to their homes. In that battle by Sarn Athrad, Beren fought his last fight, and himself slew the lord of Nogrod, and wrested from him the necklace of the dwarves. But he, dying, laid his curse upon all the treasure. Then Beren gazed in wonder on the selfsame jewel of Feanor that he had cut from Morgoth's iron crown, now shining set amid golden gems by the cunning of the dwarves. And he washed it clean of blood in the waters of the river. And when all was finished, the treasure of Doriath was drowned in the river Askar, and from that time the river was named anew Rathloriel, the Golden Bed. But Beren took the Nauglamir and returned to Tol Garlan. Little did it ease the grief of Luthien to learn that the lord of Nogrod was slain, and many dwarves beside. But it is said and sung that Luthien, wearing that necklace and that immortal jewel, was the vision of greatest beauty and glory that has ever been outside the realm of Valinor. And for a little while, the land of the dead that live became like a vision of the land of the Valar, and no place has been since so fair, so fruitful, or so filled with light. Now Dior, Thingol's heir, bade farewell to Beren and Luthien, and departing from Lanthir Lamath with Nimloth his wife, he came to Menegroth and abode there. And with them went their young sons, Elured and Elurin, and Elwing their daughter. Then the Sindar received them with joy, and they arose from the darkness of their grief for fallen kin and king, and for the departure of Melian. And Dior Eluhil set himself to raise anew the glory of the kingdom of Doriath. There came a night of autumn, and when it grew late, one came and smote upon the doors of Menegroth, demanding admittance to the king. He was a lord of the Green Elves, hastening from Osiriand, and the door wards brought him to where Dior sat alone in his chamber. And there in silence he gave to the king a coffer, and took his leave. But in that coffer lay the necklace of the dwarves, wherein was set the Silmaril. And Dior, looking upon it, knew it for a sign that Beren Echamian and Luthien Tinuviel had died indeed, and gone where go the race of men to a fate beyond the world. Long did Dior gaze upon the Silmaril, which his father and mother had brought beyond hope out of the terror of Morgoth, and his grief was great that death had come upon them so soon. But the wise have said that the Silmaril hastened their end, for the flame of the beauty of Luthien, as she wore it, was too bright for mortal lands. Then Dior arose, and about his neck he clasped the Nauglamir. And now he appeared as the fairest of all the children of the world, of threefold race, of the Edain, and of the Eldar, and of the Maiar, of the Blessed Realm. But now the rumor ran among the scattered elves of Beleriand that Dior, Thingol's heir, wore the Nauglamir, and they said, "A Silmaril of Feanor burns again in the woods of Doriath." And the oath of the sons of Feanor was waked again from sleep. For while Luthien wore the necklace of the dwarves, no elf would dare to assail her. But now, hearing of the renewal of Doriath and of Dior's pride, the seven gathered again from wandering, and they sent to him to claim their own. But Dior returned no answer to the sons of Feanor, and Celegorm stirred up his brothers to prepare an assault upon Doriath. They came at unawares in the middle of winter, and fought with Dior in the Thousand Caves. And so befell the second slaying of elf by elf. There fell Celegorm by Dior's hand, and there fell Curufin and Dark Caranthir. But Dior was slain also, and Nimloth his wife. And the cruel servants of Celegorm seized his young sons and left them to starve in the forest. Of this Maedhros indeed repented and sought for them long in the woods of Doriath. But his search was unavailing, and of the fate of Elured and Elurin no tale tells. Thus Doriath was destroyed and never rose again. But the sons of Feanor gained not what they sought, for a remnant of the people fled before them, and with them was Elwing, Dior's daughter. And they escaped, and bearing with them the Silmaril, they came in time to the mouths of the river Sirion by the sea. Of Tuor and the Fall of Gondolin. It has been told that Huor, the brother of Húrin, was slain in the Battle of Unnumbered Tears. And in the winter of that year, Rian, his wife, bore a child in the wilds of Mithrim, and he was named Tuor, and was taken to foster by Anael of the Grey Elves, who yet lived in those hills. Now when Tuor was 16 years old, the elves were minded to leave the caves of Androth where they dwelt, and to make their way secretly to the havens of Sirion in the distant south. But they were assailed by orcs and easterlings before they made good their escape, and Tuor was taken captive and enslaved by Lorgan, chief of the easterlings of Hithlum. For 3 years he endured that thraldom, but at the end of that time he escaped, and returning to the caves of Androth, he dwelt there alone, and did such great hurt to the easterlings that Lorgan set a price upon his head. But when Tuor had lived thus in solitude as an outlaw for 4 years, Ulmo set it in his heart to depart from the land of his fathers, for he had chosen Tuor as the instrument of his designs. And leaving once more the caves of Androth, he went westwards across Dor Lomin, and found Anon in Gelith, the gate of the Noldor, which the people of Turgon built when they dwelt in Nevrast long years before. Thence a dark tunnel led beneath the mountains, and issued into Kirith Niniach, the rainbow cleft, through which a turbulent water ran towards the western sea. Thus it was that Tuor's flight from Hithlum was marked by neither man nor orc, and no knowledge of it came to the ears of Morgoth. And Tuor came into Nevrast, and looking upon Belegea the great sea, he was enamoured of it, and the sound of it and the longing for it were ever in his heart and ear, and an unquiet was on him that took him at last into the depths of the realms of Ulmo. Then he dwelt in Nevrast alone, and the summer of that year passed, and the doom of Nargothrond drew near. But when the autumn came, he saw 7 great swans flying south, and he knew them for a sign that he had tarried overlong, and he followed their flight along the shores of the sea. Thus he came at length to the deserted halls of Vinyamar beneath Mount Taras, and he entered in, and found there the shield and hauberk and the sword and helm that Turgon had left there by the command of Ulmo long before. And he arrayed himself in those arms, and went down to the shore. But there came a great storm out of the west, and out of that storm Ulmo, the Lord of Waters, arose in majesty, and spoke to Tuor as he stood beside the sea. And Ulmo bade him depart from that place, and seek out the hidden kingdom of Gondolin. And he gave Tuor a great cloak to mantle him in shadow from the eyes of his enemies. But in the morning when the storm was past, Tuor came upon an elf standing beside the walls of Vinyamar. And he was Varanwë, son of Aranwë of Gondolin, who sailed in the last ship that Turgon sent into the west. But when that ship, returning at last out of the deep ocean, foundered in the great storm within sight of the coasts of Middle-earth, Ulmo took him up, alone of all its mariners, and cast him unto the land near Vinyamar. And learning of the command laid upon Tuor by the Lord of Waters, Varanwë was filled with wonder, and did not refuse him his guidance to the hidden door of Gondolin. Therefore they set out together from that place, and as the fell winter of that year came down upon them out of the north, they went warily eastward under the eaves of the mountains of shadow. At length they came in their journeying to the pools of Ivrin, and looked with grief on the defilement wrought there by the passage of Glaurung the dragon. But even as they gazed upon it, they saw one going northward in haste, and he was a tall man, clad in black and bearing a black sword. But they knew not who he was, nor anything of what had befallen in the south. And he passed them by, and they said no word. And at the last, by the power that Ulmo set upon them, they came to the hidden door of Gondolin. And passing down the tunnel, they reached the inner gate, and were taken by the guard as prisoners. Then they were led up the mighty ravine of Orfalch Echor, barred by 7 gates, and brought before Ecthelion of the Fountain, the warden of the great gate at the end of the climbing road. And there Tuor cast aside his cloak, and from the arms that he bore from Vinyamar it was seen that he was in truth one sent by Ulmo. Then Tuor looked down upon the fair vale of Tumladen, set as a green jewel amid the encircling hills. And he saw far off upon the rocky height of Aman Gwareth, Gondolin the Great, city of 7 names, whose fame and glory is mightiest in song of all dwellings of the elves in the hither lands. At the bidding of Ecthelion, trumpets were blown on the towers of the great gate, and they echoed in the hills, and far off but clear there came a sound of answering trumpets blown upon the white walls of the city, flushed with the rose of dawn upon the plain. Thus it was that the son of Huor rode across Tumladen, and came to the gate of Gondolin. And passing up the wide stairways of the city, he was brought at last to the tower of the king, and looked upon the images of the trees of Valinor. Then Tuor stood before Turgon, son of Fingolfin, high king of the Noldor, and upon the king's right hand there stood Maeglin, his sister's son. But upon his left hand sat Idril Celebrindel, his daughter. And all that heard the voice of Tuor marveled, doubting that this were in truth a man of mortal race. For his words were the words of the Lord of Waters that came to him in that hour. And he gave warning to Turgon that the curse of Mandos now hastened to its fulfillment, when all the works of the Noldor should perish. And he bade him depart and abandon the fair and mighty city that he had built, and go down Sirion to the sea. Then Turgon pondered long the counsel of Ulmo, and there came into his mind the words that were spoken to him in Vinyamar. Love not too well the work of thy hands and the devices of thy heart, and remember that the true hope of the Noldor lieth in the west and cometh from the sea. But Turgon was become proud, and Gondolin as beautiful as a memory of elven Tirion, and he trusted still in its secret and impregnable strength, though even a Valar should gainsay it. And after the Nirnaeth Arnoidiad, the people of that city desired never again to mingle in the woes of elves and men without, nor to return through dread and danger into the west. Shut behind their pathless and enchanted hills, they suffered none to enter, though he fled from Morgoth hate pursued. And tidings of the lands beyond came to them faint and far, and they heeded them little. The spies of Angband sought for them in vain, and their dwelling was as a rumour, and a secret that none could find. Maeglin spoke ever against Tuor in the councils of the king, and his words seemed the more weighty in that they went with Turgon's heart. And at the last he rejected the bidding of Ulmo, and refused his counsel. But in the warning of the Valar he heard again the words that were spoken before the departing Noldor on the coast of Ahriman long ago, and the fear of treason was wakened in Turgon's heart. Therefore, in that time, the very entrance to the hidden door in the encircling mountains was caused to be blocked up, and thereafter none went ever forth from Gondolin on any errand of peace or war while that city stood. Tidings were brought by Thorondor, Lord of Eagles, of the fall of Nargothrond, and after the slaying of Thingol and of Dior, his heir, and of the ruin of Doriath. But Turgon shut his ear to word of the woes without, and vowed to march never at the side of any son of Feanor, and his people he forbade ever to pass the leaguer of the hills. And Tuor remained in Gondolin, for its bliss and its beauty and the wisdom of its people held him enthralled. And he became mighty in stature and in mind, and learned deeply of the lore of the exiled elves. Then the heart of Idril was turned to him, and his to her. And Maeglin's secret hatred grew ever greater, for he desired above all things to possess her, the only heir of the king of Gondolin. But so high did Tuor stand in the favour of the king, that when he had dwelt there for 7 years, Turgon did not refuse him even the hand of his daughter. For though he would not heed the bidding of Ulmo, he perceived that the fate of the Noldor was wound with the one whom Ulmo had sent, and he did not forget the words that Huor spoke to him before the host of Gondolin departed from the Battle of Unnumbered Tears. Then there was made a great and joyful feast, for Tuor had won the hearts of all that people, save only of Maeglin and his secret following. And thus there came to pass the second union of elves and men. In the spring of the year after was born in Gondolin Earendil Half-Elven, the son of Tuor and Idril Celebrindal. And that was 503 since the coming of the Noldor to Middle-earth. Of surpassing beauty was Earendil, for a light was in his face as the light of heaven, and he had the beauty and the wisdom of the Eldar, and the strength and hardihood of the men of old. And the sea spoke ever in his ear and heart, even as with Tuor, his father. Then the days of Gondolin were yet full of joy and peace, and none knew that the region wherein the hidden kingdom lay had been at last revealed to Morgoth by the cries of Húrin, when, standing in the wilderness beyond the encircling mountains, and finding no entrance, he called on Turgon in despair. Thereafter, the thought of Morgoth was bent unceasing on the mountainous land between Anach and the upper waters of Sirion, whither his servants had never passed. Yet still no spy or creature out of Angband could come there because of the vigilance of the eagles, and Morgoth was thwarted in the fulfillment of his designs. But Idril Celebrindal was wise and far-seeing, and her heart misgave her, and foreboding crept upon her spirit as a cloud. Therefore in that time she let prepare a secret way that should lead down from the city, and passing out beneath the surface of the plain, issue far beyond the walls, northward of Aman Gwareth. And she contrived it, that the work was known but to few, and no whisper of it came to Maeglin's ears. Now on a time when Earendil was yet young, Maeglin was lost, for he, as has been told, loved mining and quarrying after metals above all other craft, and he was master and leader of the elves who worked in the mountains distant from the city, seeking after metals for their smithying of things both of peace and war. But often Maeglin went with few of his folk beyond the leaguer of the hills, and the king knew not that his bidding was defied. And thus it came to pass, as fate willed, that Maeglin was taken prisoner by orcs and brought to Angband. Maeglin was no weakling or craven, but the torment wherewith he was threatened cowed his spirit, and he purchased his life and freedom by revealing to Morgoth the very place of Gondolin and the ways whereby it might be found and assailed. Great indeed was the joy of Morgoth, and to Maeglin he promised the lordship of Gondolin as his vassal, and the possession of Idril Celebrindel when the city should be taken. And indeed, desire for Idril and hatred for Tuor led Maeglin the easier to his treachery, most infamous in all the histories of the elder days. But Morgoth sent him back to Gondolin, lest any should suspect the betrayal, and so that Maeglin should aid the assault from within when the hour came. And he abode in the halls of the king with smiling face and evil in his heart, while the darkness gathered ever deeper upon Idril. At last, in the year when Earendil was 7 years old, Morgoth was ready, and he loosed upon Gondolin his Balrogs and his orcs and his wolves. And with them came dragons of the brood of Glaurung, and they were become now many and terrible. The host of Morgoth came over the northern hills, where the height was greatest and the watch least vigilant, and it came at night upon a time of festival, when all the people of Gondolin were upon the walls to await the rising sun and sing their songs at its uplifting. For the morrow was the great feast that they named the Gates of Summer. But the red light mounted the hills in the north and not in the east, and there was no stay in the advance of the foe until they were beneath the very walls of Gondolin, and the city was beleaguered without hope. Of the deeds of desperate valour there done by the chieftains of the noble houses and their warriors, and not least by Tuor, much is told in The Fall of Gondolin. Of the battle of Ecthelion of the Fountain with Gothmog, lord of Balrogs, in the very square of the king, where each slew the other, and of the defence of the tower of Turgon by the people of his household until the tower was overthrown. And mighty was its fall, and the fall of Turgon in its ruin. Tuor sought to rescue Idril from the sack of the city, but Meglin had laid hands on her and on Earendil, and Tuor fought with Meglin on the walls and cast him far out, and his body as it fell smote the rocky slopes of Amon Gwareth thrice ere it pitched into the flames below. Then Tuor and Idril led such remnants of the people of Gondolin as they could gather in the confusion of the burning, down the secret way which Idril had prepared. And of that passage the captains of Angband knew nothing, and thought not that any fugitives would take a path towards the north and the highest parts of the mountains, and the nighest to Angband. The fume of the burning, and the steam of the fair fountains of Gondolin, withering in the flame of the dragons of the north, fell upon the vale of Tumladen in mournful mists. And thus was the escape of Tuor and his company aided, for there was still a long and open road to follow from the tunnel's mouth to the foothills of the mountains. Nonetheless, they came thither, and beyond hope they climbed in woe and misery, for the high places were cold and terrible, and they had among them many that were wounded, and women and children. There was a dreadful pass, Kirith Thoronath it was named, the Eagle's Cleft, where beneath the shadow of the highest peaks a narrow path wound its way. On the right hand it was walled by a precipice, and on the left a dreadful fall leapt into emptiness. Along that narrow way their march was strung when they were ambushed by orcs, for Morgoth had set watchers all about the encircling hills, and a Balrog was with them. Then dreadful was their plight, and hardly would they have been saved by the valour of yellow-haired Glorfindel, chief of the House of the Golden Flower of Gondolin, had not Thorondor come timely to their aid. Many are the songs that have been sung of the duel of Glorfindel with the Balrog upon a pinnacle of rock in that high place, and both fell to ruin in the abyss. But the Eagle's coming stooped upon the orcs and drove them shrieking back, and all were slain or cast into the deeps, so that rumour of the escape from Gondolin came not until long after to Morgoth's ears. Then Thorondor bore up Glorfindel's body out of the abyss, and they buried him in a mound of stones beside the pass. And a green turf came there, and yellow flowers bloomed upon it amid the barrenness of stone, until the world was changed. Thus, led by Tuor, son of Huor, the remnant of Gondolin passed over the mountains, and came down into the vale of Sirion. And fleeing southward by weary and dangerous marches, they came at length to Nan Tathrin, the land of willows, for the power of Ulmo yet ran in the great river, and it was about them. There they rested a while, and were healed of their hurts and weariness, but their sorrow could not be healed. And they made a feast in memory of Gondolin, and of the elves that had perished there, the maidens and the wives and the warriors of the king. And for Glorfindel the beloved, many were the songs they sang, under the willows of Nan Tathrin, in the waning of the year. There Tuor made a song for Earendil his son, concerning the coming of Ulmo, the lord of waters, to the shores of Nevrast aforetime, and the sea-longing woke in his heart, and in his son's also. Therefore Idril and Tuor departed from Nan Tathrin, and went southwards down the river to the sea. And they dwelt there by the mouths of Sirion, and joined their people to the company of Elwing, Dior's daughter, that had fled thither but a little while before. And when the tidings came to Balar of the fall of Gondolin and the death of Turgon, Iranian Gil-galad, son of Fingon, was named High King of the Noldor in Middle-earth. But Morgoth thought that his triumph was fulfilled, recking little of the sons of Feanor and of their oath, which had harmed him never, and turned always to his mightiest aid. And in his black thought he laughed, regretting not the one Silmaril that he had lost. For by it, as he deemed, the last shred of the people of the Eldar should vanish from Middle-earth and trouble it no more. If he knew of the dwelling by the waters of Sirion, he gave no sign, biding his time and waiting upon the working of oath and lie. Yet by Sirion and the sea there grew up an elven folk, the gleanings of Doriath and Gondolin. And from Bala the mariners of Círdan came among them, and they took to the waves and the building of ships, dwelling ever nigh to the coasts of Arvanian, under the shadow of Ulmo's hand. And it is said that in that time Ulmo came to Valinor out of the deep waters, and spoke there to the Valar of the need of the elves, and he called on them to forgive them, and rescue them from the overmastering might of Morgoth, and win back the Silmarils, wherein alone now bloomed the light of the days of bliss, when the two trees still shone in Valinor. But Manwë moved not, and of the counsels of his heart, what tale shall tell? The wise have said that the hour was not yet come, and that only one speaking in person for the cause of both elves and men, pleading for pardon on their misdeeds and pity on their woes, might move the counsels of the powers. And the oath of Feanor, perhaps even Manwë could not loose, until it found its end, and the sons of Feanor relinquished the Silmarils, upon which they had laid their ruthless claim. For the light which lit the Silmarils, the Valar themselves had made. In those days, Tuor felt old age creep upon him, and ever a longing for the deeps of the sea grew stronger in his heart. Therefore, he built a great ship, and he named it Earame, which is Sea Wing. And with Idril Celebrindal, he set sail into the sunset and the west, and came no more into any tale or song. But in after days it was sung that Tuor alone of mortal men was numbered among the elder race, and was joined with the Noldor whom he loved, and his fate is sundered from the fate of men. Of the Voyage of Earendil and the War of Roth. Bright Earendil was then lord of the people that dwelt nigh to Sirion's mouths, and he took to wife Elwing the Fair, and she bore to him Elrond and Elros, who are called the Half-Elven. Yet Earendil could not rest, and his voyages about the shores of the hither lands eased not his unquiet. Two purposes grew in his heart, blended as one in longing for the wide sea. He sought to sail thereon, seeking after Tuor and Idril, who returned not. And he thought to find, perhaps, the last shore, and bring, ere he died, the message of elves and men to the Valar in the west, that should move their hearts to pity for the sorrows of Middle-earth. Now Earendil became fast in friendship with Círdan the shipwright, who dwelt on the Isle of Balar with those of his people who escaped from the sack of the havens of Brithumbar and Eglarest. With the aid of Círdan, Earendil built Vingilot the Foam Flower, fairest of the ships of song. Golden were its oars and white its timbers, hewn in the birchwoods of Nimbrethil, and its sails were as the argent moon. In the Lay of Earendil is many a thing sung of his adventures in the deep and in lands untrodden, and in many seas and in many isles. But Elwing was not with him, and she sat in sorrow by the mouths of Sirion. Earendil found not Tuor nor Idril, nor came he ever on that journey to the shores of Valinor, defeated by shadows and enchantment, driven by repelling winds, until in longing for Elwing he turned homeward towards the coast of Beleriand. And his heart bade him haste, for a sudden fear had fallen on him out of dreams, and the winds that before he had striven with might not now bear him back as swift as his desire. Now when first the tidings came to Maedhros that Elwing yet lived, and dwelt in possession of the Silmaril by the mouths of Sirion, he, repenting of the deeds in Doriath, withheld his hand. But in time the knowledge of their oath unfulfilled returned to torment him and his brothers. And gathering from their wandering hunting paths, they sent messages to the havens of friendship and yet of stern demand. Then Elwing and the people of Sirion would not yield the jewel which Beren had won and Luthien had worn, and for which Dior the Fair was slain. And least of all, while Earendil their lord was on the sea, for it seemed to them that in the Silmaril lay the healing and the blessing that had come upon their houses and their ships. And so they came to pass the last and cruelest of the slayings of elf by elf, and that was the third of the great wrongs achieved by the accursed oath. For the sons of Feanor that yet lived came down suddenly upon the exiles of Gondolin and the remnant of Doriath and destroyed them. In that battle some of their people stood aside, and some few rebelled and were slain upon the other part, aiding Elwing against their own lords. For such was the sorrow and confusion in the hearts of the Eldar in those days. But Maedhros and Maglor won the day, though they alone remained thereafter of the sons of Feanor, for both Amrod and Amras were slain. Too late the ships of Círdan and Gil-galad the High King came hasting to the aid of the elves of Sirion, and Elwing was gone, and her sons. Then such few of that people as did not perish in the assault joined themselves to Gil-galad and went with him to Balar. And they told that Elros and Elrond were taken captive, but Elwing, with the Silmaril upon her breast, had cast herself into the sea. Thus Maedhros and Maglor gained not the jewel, but it was not lost. For Ulmo bore up Elwing out of the waves, and he gave her the likeness of a great white bird, and upon her breast there shone as a star the Silmaril, as she flew over the water to seek Earendil, her beloved. On a time of night, Earendil, at the helm of his ship, saw her come towards him as a white cloud exceeding swift beneath the moon, as a star over the sea moving in strange course, a pale flame on wings of storm. And it is sung that she fell from the air upon the timbers of Vingilot in a swoon, nigh unto death for the urgency of her speed, and Earendil took her to his bosom. But in the morning, with marvelling eyes, he beheld his wife in her own form beside him, with her hair upon his face, and she slept. Great was the sorrow of Earendil and Elwing for the ruin of the havens of Sirion, and the captivity of their sons, and they feared that they would be slain. But it was not so. For Maglor took pity upon Elros and Elrond, and he cherished them, and love grew after between them, as little might be thought. But Maglor's heart was sick and weary with the burden of the dreadful oath. Yet Earendil saw now no hope left in the lands of Middle-earth, and he turned again in despair, and came not home, but sought back once more to Valinor with Elwing at his side. He stood now most often at the prow of Vingilot, and the Silmaril was bound upon his brow, and ever its light grew greater as they drew into the west. And the wise have said that it was by reason of the power of that holy jewel that they came in time to waters that no vessels save those of the Teleri had known. And they came to the Enchanted Isles, and escaped their enchantment. And they came into the shadowy seas and passed their shadows. And they looked upon Tol Eressia, the lonely isle, but tarried not. And at the last they cast anchor in the bay of Eldamar, and the Teleri saw the coming of that ship out of the east, and they were amazed, gazing from afar upon the light of the Silmaril, and it was very great. Then Earendil, first of living men, landed on the immortal shores. And he spoke there to Elwing and to those that were with him, and they were three mariners who had sailed all the seas beside him, Falathar, Erelont, and Earendil were their names. And Earendil said to them, "Here none but myself shall set foot, lest you fall under the wrath of the Valar. but that peril I will take on myself alone, for the sake of the two kindreds. But Elwing answered,
Then would our paths be sundered for ever. But all thy perils I will take on myself also.